The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
The tragedy of our society is not just that the usual forms of behavior and the principles regulating this behavior are breaking down, but that a spontaneous wave of new attempts at living is developing from within the social fabric, giving man hopes and ideals that cannot yet be realized. We are people living in the world of property relationships, a world of sharp class contradictions, and of an individualistic morality. We still live and think under the heavy hand of an unavoidable loneliness of spirit. Man experiences this loneliness even in towns full of shouting, noise, and people, even in a crowd of close friends and workmates. Because of their loneliness, men are apt to cling in a predatory and unhealthy way to illusions about finding a soulmate from among the members of the opposite sex. They see sly Eros as the only means of charming away, if only for a time, the gloom of inescapable loneliness. People have perhaps never in any age felt spiritual loneliness as deeply and persistently as at the present time. People have probably never become so depressed and fallen so fully under the numbing influence of this loneliness. It could hardly be otherwise. The darkness never seems so black as when there's a light shining just ahead. That's Alexandra Kollontai writing in 1911, just after Russia's first revolution in 1905, and during the social upheavals she witnessed in all of Europe. I have two goals for this talk. One is, of course, to introduce you to who all Alexandra Kollontai was, and as a result, convince you to learn more about her as a figure of the Russian Revolution. And if this is your first time at the Socialism Conference, I would really suggest attending some talks on the Russian Revolution. It's a period in history that's important to all socialists, not just as a historical example of revolution, but as one of the only, well, pretty much the only successful working class revolution we have to look to. Although it only survived as a worker state for a brief period of time, its history offers us a unique insight into the conditions of a successful revolution and the role of a revolutionary socialist party. Kollontai's life, in particular, is thus fascinating as a window into this history, and as someone who would join the leadership of this sort of party, the Bolsheviks, but also as someone who strove to understand the changing world around her, the process of working class upheaval, and the resulting changes in the way that people related to each other. My second goal for today would be to hopefully start a discussion about the political arguments Kollontai raises during her political career as a revolutionary, namely those on interpersonal relationships and the role socialists should play in engaging with the issues of sex and gender that would normally seem to be private matters of individuals' lives. Kollontai herself would become a leader of the new commissariat government in Russia, a central figure in passing the reforms on, for instance, equality within marriage and divorce, maternity protection, socializing childcare and healthcare for women, legitimizing illegitimate children, decriminalizing contraception, abortion, and prostitution, effectively placing a young Soviet Russia decades ahead of any developed capitalist country in terms of social welfare. Kollontai was raised in a middle-class family, and as a housewife, she was able to use her free time to begin studying political literature and Marxist theory. And her husband, for his credit, was a liberal and an idealist, and worked as an engineer in industrializing towns around Russia, hoping to bring some reforms into factory life that would improve working conditions, but he seemed to be kind of oblivious to the fact that factory owners were not obligated in any way to use his reforms, and this didn't really get very far. But eventually, Kollontai decided she would join her husband on a tour of one of his client factories in the small town of Narva. And although she was supposed to be on an official tour there, she kind of wandered away from her tour guide and ended up just talking to the women who worked there and stumbling upon the room where children were left during the day while their mothers were working. And this experience in particular would be a radicalizing moment for her because she would stumble upon the body of a dead child in this room who's left under the care of a slightly older child who's still a young girl. And it wasn't just finding this dead child there, but the fact that the girl who was left in charge of her, of him was obviously very, didn't really react to the situation and was clearly desensitized to children dying all around her. Kollontai's inability to reconcile this with her husband's liberalism and her aristocratic lifestyle led her to leave her family and her husband in 1898, coincidentally, right when the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party was formed. So Kollontai's early political activity was mostly using her kind of middle-class aristocratic appearance to smuggle radical literature throughout Petrograd. She actually became very conscious of the way that she was not taken seriously by the police because they would just see her as this woman in a dress with a nice hairstyle and thought, oh, she can't be a radical. So she would use this in strategically to smuggle literature and later to actually escape police repression through her early political development. She would go on to organize strike funds and then eventually help set up educational meetings where workers could come and learn Marxist theory and politics after their shift. She only further made this challenge further more difficult for herself by insisting on inviting the women workers from these factories because women at this time were by majority totally illiterate because they were barred from official education. So she couldn't even use pamphlets that they would normally hand out at factories to kind of like set up these discussions. But she had to use a coded language in these meetings to kind of escape under the observance of police spies who were inevitably there in the audience, but also was forced to kind of curate her presentations in a way that was understandable and relatable to everyone in the audience, no matter what their background. And I think that these formative experiences for her really would create the skills that would carry her through her entire political career. By 1908, she was gaining some reputation and forced into exile, as most Russian revolutionaries were. During her time abroad, she would develop close relationships with most of the political emigre community, most importantly with Rosa Luxemburg and Clara Zetkin in Germany, and here absorbed their political arguments for recruiting women workers into the party and their kind of leadership in the way that they were setting up the Women's Congress, which they also brought her to as a delegate for the first year. And the Women's Congress was sort of an invention of Zetkin and Luxemburg as a separate meeting where women from across Russia and Asia and Europe would come and report on their own radical activity and kind of figure out how to generalize amongst themselves. And they did this right before the Comintern meeting, so they can then bring like a condensed version of these reports to the Comintern and reintegrate it into the larger project. I wanted to turn really briefly to Porter's biography of Kollontai to kind of give a picture of what Kollontai found at these women's congresses. 18 months of frustrating work had been rewarded by encouraging evidence that the women she had met were committed to defending revolutionary perspectives against all forms of narrowness and chauvinism, whether of the sexist, trade unionist, or nationalist variety. And she was confident that she could persuade her comrades to accept the German way of thinking. As she said, the fusion of male and female in the party organization, which at the time gives women autonomy to organize and agitate. And I bring this up because it's really important with the kind of arguments that she would then bring back to Russia in creating a party that would actively recruit women radicals to it. Here she would become a speaker. She would be spent on speaking tours on behalf of the Central Committee throughout Europe and the United States. I think her career at this point is kind of also characterized by her tendency to sort of wander away. She would get very bored with the sort of intelligentsia she met in any town and just go seek out workers' committees or the women in the factories again to find out what was happening on the ground. And I think this in particular gave her a special sense of being clued into where the struggle was on the ground and then bringing these experiences back into her speeches on tour, again, that was able to relate to her audiences. During this time, she became a favorite invited speaker for many workers and women's committees for her emotionally engaging style and forthright arguments. She was unique not only as a confident women speaker, which was extremely rare at the time, able to relate to the special circumstances of other women in the audience, but also as a Menshevik with principled politics, especially after 1905, when most Mensheviks at the time were being seen as kind of sidestepping the debates. Kollontai would come in with her politics right at the front and kind of cut to the heart matter at heart. The outbreak of World War I would quickly develop Kollontai into a deeply principled internationalist. And this is kind of interesting for us because if you know Kollontai, you usually hear about her today as like a feminist revolutionary writer. But at the time, her writings on women's issues were kind of ignored. And she really became famous for her anti-war agitation during World War I. In 1914, she switched into the Bolshevik Party, having seen how most Mensheviks were exposing themselves as opportunists or patriots of their respective countries, and attended the Zimmerwald Conference. By the time she returned to Russia in 1917, in the midst of the uprising there, she was immediately recognized everywhere she went as a leader of the anti-war movement, and quickly elected as a delegate to the Central Committee of Workers and Soldiers Soviet. She actually continued her speaking tour in Russia within the Russian Navy, helping to agitate within the ranks against the war and laying foundations for the future Red Army. Now, throughout her career, Kollontai did focus especially on women's issues, trying to generalize arguments that would be brought back into the party. Unfortunately, this would lead her to be sort of isolated within the RSDLP. And to kind of give context to this, the preceding movement around women's rights was mostly through the Narodnik movement, which was like a middle-class populist movement in Russia. It was mostly a radicalization of the intelligentsia, who were sort of rebelling against their parents' views of traditional marriage. They mostly believed that they could propagandize among peasants to then lead to a mass awakening that would overthrow the Tsar, and was actually like a total miss of the mark. Most peasants were the most conservative part of Russia. They thought Tsar was God. they held very tightly to traditional ideas about family and marriage. And instead, the Narodniks would form these funny communes out in the countryside where they would live, men and women in the same house, not married, and this produced this sort of free love movement, which I think we're also familiar with today, which was just totally abhorrent to the peasants around them, and they didn't understand it at all. So this was sort of the context in which the radical socialist movement was coming out of, and so most people who were familiar with the Narodnik movement brought those ideas about like equality between men and women and family into the RSDLP, and then it was sort of taken for granted that socialists already believe in equality between the sexes and it's not really something we have to talk about, or it's like a middle class idea and it's not something that workers would really be concerned about. So this is sort of this is the context in which Kollontai is trying to like work through her ideas. Unfortunately, the only other real political tendency that she had to compete with was a new form of liberal feminism, especially when the new kind of Russian parliament was formed called the Duma. And most liberal feminist organizations operated on a platform of women's suffrage, but only for propertied families. And so they would draw in working women along the ideas of like, we need representation in the Duma, we need the vote, but get us the vote and then we will represent your issues as women in the Duma for you. and Kollontai thought this was totally ridiculous. So she ended up acting against party discipline to attend meetings of these organizations. Her favorite was the Women's Union for Equality, which was sort of it was one of several women's rights organizations, many of which were founded by bourgeois philanthropic families, but it was sort of unique in the way that it was explicitly political. And it also worked on the principle of separatism. So it wanted to be, most liberal feminist organizations really thought they needed to organize separately from the male organizations. Men were not allowed to join. And so this was another reason that Kollontai or any of her comrades, if they brought up issues of sex or sexuality or women's issues within the RSDLP, it was immediately met with the suspicion, like, oh, you're trying to create like a new separatist organization. And that was clearly not the case because she was taking her cue from the German party. But this was like very early in her career, so she was still sort of unknown, and she would sneak into these meetings that were in the hundreds. So she also was paying attention to these because they were clearly drawing hundreds of working class women to them for a good reason. And then she would try to actively intervene and agitate from the floor of them. And I really think, having read her biography, that the fear of being lumped in with the liberal feminists drove her to kind of veer towards a class reductionist argument sometimes, even though it's clearly not represented in like her more thought out essays and arguments that she published later. But you know, these early shots in the dark did develop her politically and gave her some confidence in how to kind of create on-the-spot speeches. But it also helped her meet like a handful of working-class radical women who were attracted to her arguments about women's issues are in fact working-class issues, and that women should join unions and parties to bring their issues into the class struggle. She was frequently booed out of the meetings and demonstrations, sometimes physically attacked on stage. And I think it was a real detriment that she didn't have the support of her party at this point. Besides this, the main debates that she would take on in her essays were usually like concrete reforms that she saw happening in other capitalist countries already. For instance, maternity insurance, which was something that women could pay into to allow them to not become unemployed once they had to like leave work to give birth. It would sometimes even provide health care during and after childbirth. But Kollontai was very suspicious of these reforms because they were usually in response to a drop in population and in response to like needing more soldiers or more workers when people were dying from like very poor living conditions and working conditions and dangerous child labor practices, rather than in response to the needs of actual working class families. She very briefly took up the argument of birth control, but this again was kind of framed by suspicion of the state, and she thought at the time the argument for contraception was something that came out of like a neo-Malthusian motivation for the state to control the population. She really didn't trust any laws that would be passed around like controlling women's reproductive capacities, and instead placed the motivation for individual women for asking for contraception in the family itself, and argued that the responsibility of child rearing and taking care of the family needs to be taken off of individual women, individual families, and socialized, made into a responsibility of all of society. Besides this, most of her arguments are generally about rooting out women's dependence on men. And this ranged from marriage for financial stability among the middle class, and even prostitution driven by survival. Now, what I think what makes Kollontai a really prolific writer at this time is the way that she was paying attention to how women were radicalizing around their own oppression, both within the working class and in the middle class, and I guess the bourgeois class too. But she would write a lot about the kind of double shift of exploitation at work and then at home. She even sometimes described it as the triple oppression, seeing it as like separate responsibilities between the worker, the mother, and the wife. And the greatest problem facing most working women was actually the high infant mortality rate among working class families as opposed to the rest of the population. And she directly correlated these to the woman's lack of time or money to even feed themselves. So women wouldn't even have time to eat between their shifts, and then they would have a lot of like stillborn births and things like that. She saw that the way that radicalization around their oppression often placed women at, sometimes with the most conservative ideas, at the front lines of the class struggle. And by the time that these layers of women began to radicalize, they would radicalize so far left politically compared to their male counterparts that they would sometimes need to create new organizations just because the current male-dominated organizations were like too liberal for them at that point. But that also meant that they met opposition to their politics, not only from their bosses and the police, but from their own husbands as well. Getting close to the 1905 revolution in Russia, Kollontai was paying very close attention to soldatki women, who were the wives and daughters of soldiers who were being taken out of the factories and put into the trenches, the front lines of the war with Germany. And I wanted to pull this quote as well, in the way that the soldatki were kind of a special layer of radicalizing women. As men were carted off to war, thousands of women left behind could no longer support themselves or their children. Many left their villages for the cities, desperate for work, where they found jobs as low-paid servants or in the most squalid sweatshops and factories, where wages were not generally compatible with survival. And for those unable to find jobs, there was always prostitution. But the women who poured into the capital then, looking for work and for news of their loved ones at the front, were a revelation to Kollontai with their hatred of the Tsar and his ministers. The soldatki, the wives, mothers, and daughters of soldiers, previously as downtrodden and oppressed as prostitutes, were now, quote, leaving their homes, their passivity, and their ignorance behind them, and hurrying to the cities to find work or to tread the corridors of government institutions in the hope of news from a husband, a son, or a father, to stand up for their widows' pensions and to fight for their rights. Those who returned to the villages did so in a sober, hardened mood. This is from Kollontai's History of Women's Organizing in Russia. She also documents a movement that was called the Babi Bunti, which were women in the countryside essentially looting and burning landowners' estates. But she also saw this as carrying over to the kind of discontent in the cities that would eventually lead to mass strikes. The revolutions of 1917, I think, really won the argument for Kollontai within her party because of the role that women workers played in them. The February Revolution was when the mass strikes started by women workers, urged on by a combined suffering of low bread rations, high infant and maternal death rates, and the loss of husbands and sons to the war front, sort of kickstarted the February Revolution there. And I wanted to give another description because it's so good. I also wanted to remind people that the dates used in this book are the Gregorian calendar, so it sounds like it's in March, but it's actually in February according to our calendar. On the 7th of March, when workers were locked out of the Putilov Araminz plant, women took matters into their own hands and began to storm the streets. By midday, they were abandoning the bread queues, looting the bakeries, and demonstrating in the thousands, with makeshift placards saying, "Bread, our children are starving, increase our rations." Soon, women workers and soldatki from the tenements and textile factories in the Vyborg side were surging across the Neva bridges, connecting the poor suburbs with the center. They were joined by women workers of the Vasilev Island trolley bus terminus, who first visited the neighboring barracks of the 180th Infantry Regiment to win the soldiers' promise not to shoot if they came out on strike. By the 9th of March, 197,000 of Petrograd's 2 million citizens were on the streets, shouting, "Down with the war," and with the braver of them shouting, "Down with the Tsar." Students left their lectures and joined them, and women began to invade the soldiers' barracks en masse and seize their guns. They go up to the officers more boldly than the men, according to Trotsky. Taking hold of their rifles, they beseech and almost command them, "Put down your bayonets and join us." The police still remain loyal to the Tsar, but the soldiers, mainly raw recruits or family men, refused to go out, and their officers were no keener. Even the Cossacks had no wish to fight. Gathering strength over the next days, women swept through the city in food riots, political strikes, and demonstrations, demanding an end to the hunger and suffering of the past 3 years of war and launching the first revolution of 1917. By the October Revolution, and this is when the Bolsheviks specifically take power and start the Soviet government on force, Kollontai was immediately assigned Commissariat of Social Welfare because of her prolific writings about welfare and women's needs. Here, though, she was tasked with managing all orphanages, veterans' benefits, senior housing and pensions, leper colonies, disability aid, mental hospitals, and angel factories, which was a euphemism for where they would put homeless children rounded up from the street to live in squalor until they were basically old enough to escape back out onto the streets to beg and prostitute themselves. By 1922, there were about 7 million homeless children in Russia, and so this represented probably the greatest social problem facing the country, and specifically for Kollontai because of her position in the government. I think reading Kollontai's life reveals the kind of struggles that women revolutionaries faced, especially so as women. She personally was still scrutinized for her first divorce and then romantic relationships she would have with comrades. Probably the biggest scandal was in the middle of the revolution in 1917 when she married a man who was a peasant and 15 years younger than she was. Even though this was Dybenko and he would go on to be a leading insurgent from the Navy and like a leader of the Red Army, the main thing everyone was concerned about was that she was from an aristocratic family and marrying beneath her. Most of the anti-communist publications in and out of Russia would generally attack her as basically a slut, accusing her of having many husbands or being Lenin's mistress. Kollontai, for her part, seemed to pay very little attention to these things. It was like she was kind of distracted. And if she did write about them in her memoirs, it was usually to complain that organizing left very little time for love or romance. And I think this would actually be reflected in the way she theorized about women's sexuality and arguing that women should put their political and intellectual desires ahead of their romantic desires. So all of this is to context the namesake of this talk, her essay, Sexual Relations and the Class Struggle. It's a pretty different essay from a lot of her earlier writings, which were more concrete and about kind of legal reforms. This, I think, she's trying to get to the way that ideas change through struggle, but also, I think, an intervention between both an idealist, kind of individualist art perspective on one side and the sort of class reductionist perspective on the other side. Her arguments against idealism, I think, are actually talking about the Narodnik movement. She especially attacks this idea of free love in the way that it doesn't really root out the reasons why women are subjugated in Russian society. It doesn't provide any kind of analysis of class society. And she argues instead perpetuates women's subjugation under new rhetoric and ideas and gives men different excuses to continue sexually abusing the women in their lives. Here she also starts to bring in some psychological aspects of sex under capitalism, which I find like years ahead of her time. As I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, she mentions feelings of loneliness, something that I think we would call alienation today. The fact that competition between workers also leads to competition for partners, jealousy, predatory behavior, she all kind of sees as a part of like sex under capitalism. She even says, the claims that we make on our contracted partner, which is should be your partner in marriage, are absolute and undivided. We are unable to follow the simplest rule of love, that another person should be treated with great consideration. And I love that quote because I think she's actually starting to describe politics of consent that we have today. That was just totally new for her time. Further, she argues against idealist perspectives, instead for the need of a social revolution and struggle to produce the new forms of sexual relationships that would be truly free of oppressive ideas. She starts to describe the process of changing consciousness and even the ability of people to kind of smooth over contradictions in their morality or personal codes. This brought for me things that Gramsci would later write like 10 or 15 years ahead of her. So here's like an excerpt from Kollontai. It's surprising that in the face of the contradictory entangled forms of present day personal relationships, people are able to preserve a faith in moral authority and are able to make sense of these contradictions and thread their way through these mutually destructive and incompatible moral codes. Even the usual justification, I live by the new morality, doesn't help anyone since the new morality is still only in the process of being formed. Our task is to draw out from the chaos of present-day contradictory sexual norms the shape and make clear the principles of a morality that answers the spirit of the progressive and revolutionary class. I would compare this to an excerpt from Gramsci. The active man in the mass has a practical activity and has no clear theoretical consciousness of his practical activity, which nonetheless involves understanding the world insofar as it transforms it. His theoretical consciousness can be historically in opposition to his activity. One might almost say that he has two theoretical consciousnesses, or one contradictory consciousness. One which is implicit in his activity and which in reality unites him with all fellow workers in the practical transformation of the real world. And one, superficially explicit or verbal, which he has inherited from the past and uncritically absorbed. The person is strangely composite. It contains Stone Age elements and principles of a more advanced science, prejudices of all past phases of history at the local level, and institutions of a future philosophy which will be that of a human race united the world over. Further, Kollontai would start to argue that the way that the bourgeoisie, or the ruling class, takes ideas and actually weaponizes them to maintain and preserve the core unit of the economy, which is the family, and even preserve the way that they can pass on their private property through their lineage. But shows how contradictory this is in its own right, in the way that new forms are responses to the needs of the working class, but are then absorbed by the ruling class to become more flexible. She argues here that responding to the needs of working class, or even to pressures of the economy and new developments in technology and economic developments, really drive toward destroying the core family structure, and especially among the working class, drives towards what, you know, she was already seeing as like a socializing of the family and a socializing of child rearing and things like that. She sees that this would actually remove the basis of sexual inequality within the family and should make relations between men and women more fluid. For her, class struggle is necessary to drive workers away from individualistic bourgeois morality and in the process develop a collective class consciousness. So on the other side, though, she's also arguing against class reductionism or economic reductionism, which is sort of this idea that women's oppression will automatically fall away through the struggle or after the revolution with a new economic system. And she brings up some examples of how women across classes are oppressed by the class system. For instance, she brings up this concept of the double standard. Which is pretty interesting because for us, the double standard tends to describe the way that women, that men, it's socially acceptable for them to have many partners, for women, not so much. Here she actually uses it to describe a double standard within the middle class in marrying beneath them, which I think she has some personal attachments to. But she describes it this way: we are used to evaluating a woman not as a personality with individual qualities and failings, irrespective of her physical and emotional experience, but only as an appendage of a man. This man, the husband or the lover, throws the light of his personality over the woman. And it is this reflection, and not the woman herself, that we consider to be the true definition of her emotional and moral makeup. In the eyes of society, the personality of a man can be more easily separated from his actions in the sexual sphere. The personality of a woman is judged almost exclusively in terms of her sexual life. This type of attitude stems from the role that women have played in society over the centuries. And at this point, she's actually starting to refer to women's reproductive role in the materialist analysis that's really the backbone of all of these arguments that she's bringing up. By the end of her essay, she starts to argue about what she would call a comradely morality, which is really like a new moral code that's being produced by working class struggle. And argues specifically that concepts of submission within marriage or between men and women should be in contradiction to a concept of comradely morality or comradely relationships. And for her is the main barrier from men solidarizing with women. She also identifies the responsibility that women have to the home that keeps them within the home, within the private sphere, without actually using this vocabulary, as the main barrier for women entering the productive and political sphere of society and like entering class struggle. So she's basically setting up the argument that the responsibilities of the individual family have to be lifted away from women in order for them as a group en masse to enter political life. I think between these two arguments, she's essentially setting up a middle road argument of like why socialists and revolutionaries have to have something to say to women about their everyday experiences, have to have something to say about the way that people relate to one another in their interpersonal relationships in order to actively recruit women and recruit people along these lines to the socialist movement. I don't want to take up too much time. I guess I'll just kind of skip to some further arguments she makes towards class reductionism. And the separation between private and social spheres of society, and especially this argument she has about the way women are excluded into the private family, can actually be reproduced in the way that class reductionists decide that women's issues should be relegated to private life. And she thinks that this is actually perpetuating sexism, essentially. By the end of it, she begins to argue that working class struggle is already producing new forms of sexual relationships. She kind of has a list of like a dozen different forms of marriage and relationships that are starting to be produced, even if they're not officially recognized. And that it's a sign that the old bourgeois morality has to be swept away and kind of thrown into the dustbin of history once new socioeconomic relationships have also changed. She correlates the way that progressive movements can cause experimentation in these relationships, but it's really the economic developments materially that force pressures on old forms of relationships and give way to adaptations within both bourgeois and working class families. And she brings up examples such as like the delayed age in marriage, seeking to regulate childbirth, growth in prostitution rates, all associated with an increase in poverty and economic crisis. Overall, she argues that there's no way to actually predict what new forms of relationships will come about under socialism, and kind of expects that the socialist society will produce forms of sexuality and interpersonal relationships that will be totally unrecognizable to us today. To wrap up, I want to pose a few questions for discussion. First of all, was Kollontai right to criticize concepts of free love? Are sexual or interpersonal relationships an issue that socialists should take up and have an opinion on? And if so, what should that opinion be? What is the relationship between the development of progressive ideas about sexual relationships or class struggle, and what is the role of socialists in that process? I have to admit right now that I agree with Kollontai that socialists should have something to say about women's oppression, about sex and gender, and actively recruit people into the socialist movement along the lines of their own oppression. I also agree that ideas held by society are often weaponized as tools by the ruling class, and we have to learn to do the same. So I'll conclude with what I see as her sharpest attack on class reductionism from her essay. It is an old truth that every new class that develops as a result of an advance in economic growth offers mankind an appropriately new ideology. The code of sexual behavior is a part of this ideology. However, it is worth saying something about the proletarian ethics or proletarian sexual morality in order to criticize the well-worn idea that sexual morality is no more than superstructure, and that there is no place for any change in this sphere until the economic base of society has been changed. As if the ideology of a certain class is formed only when the breakdown in these socioeconomic relationships, guaranteeing the dominance of that class, has been completed. All the experience of history teaches us that a social group works out its ideology and consequently its sexual morality in the process of its struggle with hostile social forces. To search for the basic criteria for morality that can reflect the interests of the working class and to see that the developing sexual norms are in accordance with these criteria, this is the task that must be tackled by the ideologists of the working class. We have to understand that it is only by becoming aware of the creative process that is going on within society and of the new demands, new ideals, and new norms that are being formed that we can possibly make sense of the chaos and contradictions of sexual relationships and find the thread that will make it possible to undo the tightly rolled up tangle of sexual problems. We must remember that only a code of sexual morality that is in harmony with the problems of the working class can serve as an important weapon in strengthening the working class's fighting position. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.